VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Will Kelleher and you're listening to our special series examining just what it takes to win the Rugby World Cup in the company of those who have been there and done it. We'll take you from 1987 to 2019 through the eyes of great world champions ahead of the 10th World Cup in France this autumn. We'll hear their memories and stories, anecdotes and insights, all with the goal of answering one simple but devilish question. How do you win the World Cup? So join us on a rugby journey to whet your appetite for France with Legends of the Game. This time on How to Win the World Cup, we're tackling two tournaments in one, 2011 and 2015, the unparalleled era of dominance from the mighty All Blacks. In 2011, William and Kate tie the knot as the King's Speech wins four Oscars. India hoist Sachin Tendulkar high as they win the Cricket World Cup in Mumbai and the final Harry Potter film is released. New Zealand is heavy with expectation and racked with nerves as they host the World Cup, a competition they incredibly haven't won since 1987. It's tense and tight, but whitebait fisher cum goal kicker Stephen Donald is the last fly half standing to hit a penalty, and the All Blacks beat France at Eden Park. The auspicious score? 8-7. Their dominance continues through 2015, with New Zealand losing just three times and drawing twice in 54 tests over 4 years. While top gear splits from Clarkson, May and Hammond, Wayne Rooney scores his record-breaking 50th England goal, and Justin Bieber tops the charts, the All Blacks keep on winning. Their run takes them to the top of the tree again, beating Australia at Twickenham to become the first team to win World Cups back-to-back. At the centre of the black wash, and in the centre for both tournaments, was Conrad Smith. So, from The Times and The Sunday Times, this is a Ruck special, How to Win the World Cup with Conrad Smith. Right, so Conrad Smith, a great pleasure having you on this special Ruck. Let's start with the easiest question of all. It's the title of the podcast, after all. How do you win the World Cup, Conrad Smith?
Finally I could give you a simple answer. my first thought that came into me was a lot of hard work and a bit of luck, probably. That's probably the honest answer. It's I think being fortunate enough to win two of them, being involved in three though, so seeing the other side in 07, it was certainly the times we won was after a lot of preparation, a really strong group of players, and an ounce of luck. I think you need things to go your way, and whether that's because you in a high performance environment, you probably think that the luck comes your way because you've earned it, or there's rugby gods that smile on you, but there's certainly an element of that comes in every time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, we'll try and find an answer by the end of our chat, but why don't we lay some context for our listeners who might not remember everything about 2011 and 2015, your two wins. So, I mean, I suppose for everyone else in the world, it was sort of this remarkable thing that the All Blacks weren't winning World Cups, because you're pretty much always the number one team in the world, always the best team in the world between World Cups for a long time, but hadn't won one since 87, the first one. So how heavily did that weigh on you guys, maybe particularly after 07 with getting knocked out to France in Cardiff and all the controversy around the forward pass and everything? How did it feel as a New Zealander with that on your back?
Yeah, it was, and it was probably, you know, a lot of the work that we did was confronting that. And when I look back to 11, I think most of them in that group realised how beneficial it was that we'd been through 2007. We kept the same coaching group. There was a large player group that had stayed together, and I think that worked in our favour because all the work we were doing on the field we knew wasn't enough. And so one of the first things we did in preparation for 2011 was look at the reason why we weren't winning World Cups. We'd had great All Black teams, and a lot of us, as I say, had been there in 07. We knew we had a great team. Still look back, it's probably one of the best teams I was involved in. No one remembers it like that. They knocked out in the quarters, but honestly, it was an incredible team. And so what was it that was making us come unstuck? And I think we recognised just the uniqueness of the World Cup and how it was completely different to any other tournament, and how we as an All Black unit weren't recognising that. So we were going into World Cups and we weren't arrogant at all, but we were confident, and we just trusted what we'd done because we'd won Bledisloes, we'd won Tri-Nations as they were then, we'd won, you know, most things that we were confronted with. So we thought, oh, this will work again. But it wasn't. This was something, a totally new beast. And it was becoming more and more like that, you know, World Cups in the 87. It was, the beast has evolved, and there was a lot more hype around them. And we just had to recognise that. So to come into 2011, as I say, I think that was one of the key things that we did as a team. Wasn't so much the on-field, but that recognition of the World Cup, everything that comes with it. And so there was a lot of mental preparation as to how we were going to deal with that and approach it differently than what we do to other tests and other tournaments.
So how did you actually go about that? Because the modern player, and we're, I don't know, 10 or so years on from that, would look at every week and just say, it's about this week, and then it's about next week, it's about today, and then it's about tomorrow. But you there were actively addressing the World Cup as this big thing that you needed to nail. So at what point in the cycle did you kind of start going, look, we really need to have an adult conversation about this?
Yeah, it was probably, and to be like a lot of the, like you say, you probably don't get the young guys in the team to talk about that because they're elsewhere and they're going to follow leaders. So you just make sure that leadership group, and really that's where the whole idea of a leadership group really took shape in the All Black environment, because we realise the importance of those conversations, but equally that we can't have that conversation with everyone in the team. So it was down to a sort of a select group, the older, more experienced, but also the influential players that would talk about this, you know, the idea of the World Cup, what it required. And mainly it was just the recognition that it was different, there were different pressures, how that was going to influence, how that influenced teams, how that influences referees, how that influences the crowd, the media, and how it all, you know, makes up, and just what we could do. Some of it you can't control, but what you can control and how you go into that. And then once that leadership group had a good feel for that, spent some time processing that, then, yeah, we sort of just let that transfer onto the wider squad.
Yeah, I suppose it must have focused the mind as well that it was a home World Cup. It was your World Cup. It was, I don't know, the expectation and everything was probably absolutely through the roof, and it was maybe a sense of, we've got to get it done this time. Was that fair?
Yeah, I think that's completely clear. I think, you know, given the number of missed opportunities and the fact that the group had been together, as I say, through that disappointment, maybe I'd like to think it would have happened that way anywhere, but you're right, like there was added pressure around it being at home. There was probably an added sense that, yeah, we've got to get this we've got to get this right for ourselves and for all, you know, the support that we receive. It was it was a real feeling of duty through that World Cup, and a lot of guys used that word, and I understand why we used it, I think.
But that's the funny thing, because for us maybe who live up the other end of the world and look at the All Blacks as this kind of like almost, I don't know, unhuman bunch of people who are just like supremely talented, wear the black shirt that's all scary and different and don't have these kind of human fallibilities. But it sounds like you had quite, maybe vulnerable is the wrong word, but like a group that understood the pressures and felt them and rode them and, I don't know, had to really confront lots of different things about yourselves in the whole thing as well. It wasn't sort of as serene maybe as other people saw it from the outside.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I think, the first thing most, you know, sports people will tell you, that what you see, there's so much more beneath the surface that goes into, whether it's a World Cup performance or a gold-winning performance for an Olympian. You know, there's all sorts that goes on behind, and it's never smooth sailing. Never, ever. If it's smooth sailing, it would have ended in failure, I guarantee you. Yeah. For us, it was through 07. And then another important part was 2009, you know, when reflecting on 2011, where we lost three in a row to Springbok team, who had our number. And it was, you know, the only time, and I've said this before, but the only time in my career where I actually, you know, felt we weren't the best in the world. Like, we had lost test matches, but we always felt, oh, well, if I played you the next week, we'd win. Mm-hmm. But that Springbok team in 2009, I mean, they beat us three in a row. We did not have the answers, and that was really vulnerable. Like, you talk about more black again, it's not an arrogance, but there's always a confidence that goes with us. But at that time, that was a real low point. But it was the how we came out of that was a big part of sort of 2011 as well.
Yeah. So when we get to 11 itself, I mean, the pool stage was fairly serene, lots of big results. I mean, beat Tonga convincingly, beat Japan, Canada convincingly, had a good win against France, Argentina too. But does the wobble come with you all when you start seeing all these people getting injured and losing fly halves or first fives, as you guys would say, out left, right and centre? Dan Carter goes down, Colin Slade, Aaron Crude and Piri Weep, and you start going, God, is this not meant to happen? What's going on? The curse.
Yeah, and funnily, like, so that work, I sort of talked about how we had looked at World Cups. The thing that came up was that we knew it wasn't going to be smooth sailing, to use that term again. We knew things would go wrong, and we wouldn't know what, whether it was referees, whether it was a team playing out of their skin in front of us that we wouldn't expect, or ourselves just having a really bad day. But something would happen. And we didn't talk about injuries, but yeah, that was the thing that happened. And so I remember, like, as the injuries were occurring, thinking, and this was a good thing, and this is why I think I valued the preparation rather than thinking, oh, this is a curse. I was like, this is it. This was our challenge that we knew was going to happen. We didn't think it would be injuries, but that's what it is this time. We're getting forced to play a team that isn't the one we wanted to play, or even the second, you know, string in terms of those positions. So that was our approach, and it wasn't easy. And I think maybe it was impacted by that work we'd done building up, but it was just not falling into that negative trap. And when the injuries happened, even when it was Dan, and even when it was the third one, it was always like, okay, it's just a challenge. If we're going to win this, we're going to overcome these types of challenges. And that's the way we tried to deal with it.
It seems like the world didn't know at the time, but there were more injuries than that. Richie McCaw apparently had a broken foot, and it was pretty much swollen blue and black for the final. And what do you remember of that? Was it strapped together with tape? What was going on with Richie's foot?
Yeah, I mean, he didn't let on too much, but I mean, he wasn't training a lot. We knew he was battling, because he's, you know, one guy, if he can play, he'll train, and if he can train, he'll give it his all. So, you know, we knew he had his battles. I mean, Mills is another player, Mills Milena, who was our most experienced back, and he and sort of people focus on the tens, but I know for myself personally that was a big loss, having him out injured, and there were others. So you're right, it wasn't just the tens, but we also, as I said before, approached it the same way. I wouldn't let myself dwell on it. It was easy to, and you'd do it for a second or two, but you just had to get into that mindset of moving past it and you know, focusing things we can control and looking forward to the games ahead.
So everyone's heard the famous white baiting story, Stephen Donald out fishing and then called out and kicked the goal in the final. But the funnier bit maybe was apparently he was wearing a really tiny shirt. He had a chance to have it tailored differently or something and said, oh, I'm going to fit it, don't worry. And then I actually had to put it on in the World Cup final. It doesn't fit at all. Muffin top coming out.
Well, you could see it yourself. That's what I think, you know, these replays that are meant to be the, you know, the folklore in New Zealand rugby history. And there he is with his jersey and he keeps having to pull it down over his...
Oh, the most prepared team in the world. Their fly half doesn't have a shirt that fits.
Yeah.
That's mad, isn't it? So, talk us about that final because, again, people were watching it at the dead of night up our way, but the flying V, France and the Haka, one of the tightest finals you've ever seen, 8-7, I mean, low scoring, Tony Woodcock's try through the middle of the line out. At what point did you think, God, this is not going our way? And then was it the relief at the end? Was it joy? How did it all play out for you emotionally?
Yeah, a lot of relief at the end. I through the game, it was we knew it wasn't going our way. And again, I feel like I keep harping back to this, but it was we in our preparation. We knew there was going to be a chance that we weren't, you know, on song in a game. And you hope that you don't get that. You certainly hope you don't have that in the final. But looking back, I mean, it was we'd had a semi-final where we played out of our skins, like one of the best performances in my whole career in terms of team performances. We were just
against Australia,
we're a team and that team we were expecting to meet in the final. They'd given us real tough challenges leading up, so there was it was an easy game to prepare for. The semi-final, the final, we'd beaten the French in the first round. We'd seen France lose to Tonga. We knew all their problems. There were talk of it was all playing into their hands, you know. And I've talked to Thierry Dussatoir and that since, and it's just one of those games you know you don't want to fall into that trap of being complacent, but it's hard to fake, like, to genuinely prepare and get up for a game when you've got all these other things that are sort of pulling, relaxing you. And that's the way it played out, you know. There was the injuries as well. It was just nothing was going right and for us on the field, and, you know, compared to the week before. So then it just became a matter of how are we going to guts this out. We knew we weren't going to win early on. I knew we weren't going to win this game by a lot of points. It was going to be an arm wrestle, and we just had to find a way to win this game. And if it was meant with a reserve 10 kicking a penalty in the last minute, then that's what we'd do. And that's what I think in previous World Cups, that would have made us panic as an All Black team. When things weren't happening, you know, we would have, but we didn't. We actually played pretty conservatively, deliberately, because we were like, right, this isn't functioning. We just need to, it's not going to be easy, but get ourselves over the line. And so, yeah, when we got there, it was relief. It was, and the whole enormity of the whole thing didn't sink in for a long time.
Yeah, I was going to say that, because it was a relief, maybe more so than just outright joy, did it take some time to really realise what you'd done? You've finally done it. And I know you went round the country, didn't you, on bus tours and things like that, which you did after 2015 too, coming back after that England one. But how long did it take to kind of finally realise, like, oh my God, we've done it, we did it?
Yeah, I think a lot longer. Like those, you know, next few days are pretty mad, you know, certainly enjoyable, but... it's just such a World Cups are a long campaign. I struggle at the best of times being in a team environment for too long. You know, I'm pretty someone that I enjoy it while it's in, but any chance I get away. Like I travelled for 3 months after that that experience. It was just to get my head out of it.
Oh, but right. Did you go around Europe or something? Did you early a bit late?
No, we yeah. South America, and
oh, wow.
I was backpacking. I did Machu Picchu within about a week of playing that final. So,
amazing.
And it was all pre-planned because I knew, like, win or lose, even if we probably more so if we lost, I wanted to get out of the country and just escape. So, like that was, and it was probably like during that sort of trip where I'm, and I've talked about before. I know some people weren't aware I was a player, and I was. In March, I think it was March, it was somewhere in South America, and they were talking about rugby, and they were talking about the All Blacks, and they talked about how great it was. And I remember sitting and hearing that, and I was it might have been that moment for me. I was like, oh, this is cool hearing people talk about, you know, the All Blacks winning a World Cup rather than
in Peru.
Yeah, and then somewhere, you know, totally distant. So that is, it was nice.
That is fun, yeah.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
So when, because obviously we've got you on because you've won two, so when does it then kick in that you go, right, and now we're going to do it back to back? No one's done that before, and we want not just to win a World Cup, but we want to be, like a lot of your colleagues have talked about, not just being a good All Black, but a great All Black. Where did that all kick in and continuing it on and, I don't know, laying down a sort of unbeatable legacy maybe? You might not have used those words, but that's kind of what you did by winning a second one.
Yeah, and that was certainly part of it. Was during that cycle, and what I said before, like the way World Cups have evolved as a beast, like early on, like even when I, in 2007, it was sort of a year into 2007, you started talking World Cups, whereas now it's a four-year cycle, and teams will even, you know, coaches will be employed for 4 years, and they'll have teams they pick in the first year that they plan to be picking in the third, or, you know, it's crazy. So By 15, we were almost at that stage where I was probably, I don't know, again, probably only within the sort of coaching and leadership group that you start planning from 2012 for 2015. And immediately it was, as part of that planning, it was the appeal of going back-to-back, winning one away from home, and also winning one playing really good rugby, because we felt, you know, as good as it was, like that 8-7, it did stick with us a little bit. We had been great up until then, but that wasn't a great performance. And I mean, we had our reasons. We were down on soldiers. We were struggling, but it would be nice, you know, if we're going to win another one, if we're going to go back to back, let's play great rugby, let's score tries. And that was the goal, I think, going into that, into 2015.
Yeah. So now that you've had you're a few years retired and you're still working in rugby, do you look at that run between the end of 2011 and the end of 2015? I was looking at it. You won 91% of your test matches, and I think you lost three games. That was it. Three times and drew twice in 54 test matches. Did you quite, because you're going week to week and everything else, you probably don't look at it as a whole. But now you can. Do you just go, that is ridiculous and probably never going to be repeated?
Yeah, you're right. I think at the time we definitely, like we were aware and we enjoyed every win we had. We were never, you know, a team that sort of had a win and just looked at Nigara Fui, we made sure we celebrated everyone. But I think there's no doubt. I look back now and probably appreciate it a whole lot more than what I did at the time. And I think that's natural. Like, as a player, you're as good as you play, especially in that All Black environment. You just like, and it's funny you mentioned the losses. Like, I won't remember those wins, but I remember every loss.
Go on then, talk us through them.
And even the games we.
What were the defeats? Come on, let's do them. Let me find them.
No, and that's what.
The England one was, people up this way will remember, in 2012.
Well, that's an easy one.
Yeah, Australia 2015, just before the World Cup.
Australia that cost us and I left that to be with my wife for the birth of my son, and the team drew and missed out on a world record of consecutive wins, and they all blame me.
brutal. But that's. I mean, I suppose that's.
Yeah.
Do you look at it and go? It sounds arrogant, but maybe it's the way you need to think. That at the time there were things written about the All Blacks saying that this desperation to be the most dominant team in rugby history was part of it. Was that true? Was that something that you did talk about and just say, we want to not just be known as decent All Blacks and good players, we want to be the best that's ever been?
Yeah, I think there was an element of that, but I think the important part was that we knew that was, we talked about it as an aspiration, as a goal, and that something we'd never achieve, but there was real strength in pursuing it, if you know what I mean. Mm. And so that way you don't ever get arrogant and you don't think you are. And that's a big difference, you know, when you think you're the best of all time, you know, I think you're missing the point. But if you're aspiring to be that way, then that's guiding you and the way you train, the way you play, the way everything you do, you know, that's what we were trying to do. And it was led a large extent, again, by, you know, our skipper and the coaching group at the time. And I suppose the leadership group that were all pretty united in those goals for the whole group. And that's really what drove the team to do those sort of special things over that period of time, I think.
It's something a lot of players talk about is the desperation or the goal of always trying to play the perfect game. And you probably never actually get there, do you, of thinking that was absolutely perfect. But do you think you got close in 2015? I mean, the one I actually went to, it was my first year as a journalist, but I just went along as a fan to the France quarterfinal in Cardiff, laying to rest all of those 07 demons, 60 points, Julian Savea hat-trick. Yeah. From an outsider's perspective, that felt pretty perfect. But what would be yours? I mean, obviously winning the final, but that was pretty sensational, that one.
I think that game, that quarterfinal, the semi-final I mentioned before, there was a game in 2010 where we beat South Africa in Eden Park after they had, you know, had our number in 2009, which I talked about before. That'd be games, and again, not all of them you score the most points, but just ones where from the first minute, I don't know, it was just a real feeling in the team that this was, we had all turned up to play our best games ever. And like, I remember even that quarterfinal, French were actually playing really well, but I think the score was still pretty close, probably 20, 30 minutes into the game, but I just kept thinking, we're going to, you know, this is incredible. Everything we were doing, every player was doing, taking the right option. We were all seeing the same thing. We were just humming. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, you don't relax during the game and think, oh, we're amazing. But it is something. There's a definite sense that it's all going to plan, and you don't often get it. And when it is, it's pretty special. So, I'd put that quarterfinal in that sort of select group for myself anyway.
So then the final, and again, outsider's perspective, you've got some of the greats of the game all retiring on their shields with a World Cup gone back to back. That can't get much better, can it? I mean, for you, Dan Carter, Richie McCaw, Mar Nonu, Tony Woodcock, Kevin Mialamu, last game in an All Black shirt, World Cup final at Twickenham, lifting the Webb Ellis Trophy. Like, had you talked about it at all between the few of you to say, we're going to retire, we're all planning the same thing? Or was it just completely like, don't mention it, because otherwise we'll think about what's coming next rather than what's coming now?
Yeah, no, it wasn't sort of in between that. Like we definitely didn't sort of make it about ourselves because none of us, individually would ever wanted to go down that route. And, we all sat at the back of the bus together by that stage. We were all the most experienced. So there were plenty of conversation. So I mean, we were all aware that we were moving on, but you're all such different journeys, like some, like Richie was, that was it. Matt and myself were sort of going to continue on in France. Dan, we were all doing our own
Mark's still
things.
playing. He's still going, isn't he?
Yeah, Mark still. He made it clear even then he would play as long as he could. He was nothing was going to make him hang up his boots. But so yeah, I think we there was I think it was inside all of us, but it wasn't definitely wasn't a team thought. And I've said before, it actually is a really good way to go out because you because it's a World Cup, you can't possibly think about yourself like you, it doesn't happen. Whereas, I mean, I played my last game in France, my last proper game, and I was a wreck because it was just a regular season match, and I got really emotional and because of all these things, like suddenly I'm. Whereas with the All Blacks, because it was a World Cup final, it was right. It's a World Cup final. We need to win a World Cup final. The idea that it was also your last match was sort of something that was bubbling on the side, but certainly not front of mind. And that's the way it was, I think, for all of us.
So how different is the party in 15 than after 11? You're 4 years older. You've got a long flight home. There's always that story of old Ashes cricket tours where they try and do the challenge of drinking as many cans of beer as possible. Was there any of that going on the Big Bird back home?
No, sadly, I don't know. I know the stories about cricket games. I don't know, they're just different beasts than rugby players. But like I said before, the idea is great because but you're just exhausted. Like those campaigns are so long. I know, like you definitely enjoy yourselves. You have a night out, but I think everyone's sort of just at the end of their tether, and they're wanting to. I'm sure it's over the Christmas period for most of us that we sort of celebrate a bit more. I mean. And especially when it was in London, I think we didn't fly straight away, but we had the World Rugby Awards the next day and sort of go through that and then jump on the plane, get back, and there were parades and it was a long few days and there was definitely celebrating, but there was also a lot of sleeping and a lot of rest. That's the way I remember it.
So I suppose we should end where we started then. And while you've been chatting to us, I've been writing down a few sort of buzzwords and maybe we could, I don't know, try and come up with an answer. How do you do it? So, a lot of hard work, a lot of learning off past failures for you guys. It's not smooth sailing, disaster planning, bit of luck. What are we settling on? How do you do it? Or how did you guys do it, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's somewhere in there. You've got an answer. You need a pretty special. You need talent. Like you need good players, but you certainly the leadership is a big thing. It's like any team, you're going to struggle to get a lot of success without those two elements. And then I think recognition of a World Cup, of what it's about. And you look at this World Cup, even there's not a lot of World Cup experience within the favourite teams, and that's I think that's something that they can't do anything about. But I think it is still something they need to put a lot of thought to because it can trip you up because these games will be different than the ones they've won up until now. Totally different. They think they would have had pressure to Six Nations, but yeah, this is a whole new, as I say, beast. And that's really important. Some preparation in terms of that across the team, just to acknowledge how unique a World Cup is and the ability to deal with that. So, and that really does fall, I think, on the leadership and the senior members of the team. So sorry to throw it into this World Cup. I don't know if this is a focus, but it makes it really interesting, this World Cup.
But knowing the All Black mindset as you do you think that as much as they would have wanted to win a lot in the last 4 years, it might help them in some ways? That there's more eyes looking elsewhere, there's less pressure maybe, there's less the sort of, well, it's obviously going to be the All Blacks kind of talk around it, whether they ignore it or listen to it or not.
Yeah.
And also on the other side, maybe beware the All Blacks who are slightly under the radar, perhaps. I mean, you can never really be under the radar as an All Black, but you know what I mean? It's not the same as 11 and 15, is it? Or even 19,
Yeah.
maybe.
I agree. Yeah, I agree with that, and I think it will be beneficial. But like a lot of these things, that it's how you use that to your in your advantage. So I think it is something they can definitely use, and I think it can motivate them. But I don't think they're going to catch many other teams by surprise, as you say. And the truth is that this will be the hardest challenge for an All Black team. Like, I say that honestly. Like, as much as proud as I am of our achievements, I don't think we ever played in a time where the rugby was as competitive as it is now. And, you know, that's just the reality of the way the rugby is the quality of the teams in the North that we probably didn't have at our time. Hopefully that's not coming across as being disrespectful, but it was just, when I played, there was a fear of teams in the North, but mainly the Australians, you know, and South Africa, whereas now I know the group, I think that way more about, you know, the Irish and French and even the other teams are dangerous. So yeah, it's a very much a different tournament, which is great.
That's interesting, because I don't know whether you'd agree with this, but maybe the sort of haranguing over the defeats over the last couple of years might be misplaced then. If you're saying that the scene is better across the world, so losing one or two or three or four in a year is, by your old standards, a complete disgrace, basically, because you didn't do that. But for this group, it's a different scene around the world, maybe. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's my view, absolutely. And it might be impacted a little bit by, you know, my being in Europe for a long time, and so I was exposed a lot more and seeing the rugby up north, and probably got a, you know, new appreciation and was just exposed to the growth even at the domestic club level that I saw while I was up there. But I think that's you know, definitely my view about the recent form of the All Blacks, that it's no small part down to actually how much better quality the teams in the North are and how they're playing.
Well, look, Conrad, it's been an absolute pleasure. We've taken loads of your time, but really appreciate it. We've run through 2011, we've run through 2015, double World Cup wins. You went out on your shield in the perfect way, and that you handled all the pressure and everything else. So awesome to have you, and thanks so much for joining us.
Not a problem. It's always nice reliving these memories, so anytime.
So there you go. That's how to win not just one, but two World Cups back to back from Conrad Smith. It's about treating the World Cup as a different tournament. It's about learning from your past failures. And it does help to have some of the greats of the game all playing at the same time in your team. You've been listening to a Ruck podcast special, How to Win the World Cup. Like and subscribe, spread the word, and follow the Times on social media at Timesport. This podcast was produced by Alfie Reynolds.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.